administration is working every day to lift the burdens on our companies and on our workers so that you can thrive, compete, and grow. And at the very center of that plan is a giant, beautiful, massive, the biggest ever in our country, tax cut. We will cut taxes for everyday, hardworking Americans, and we're going to cut them substantially. American families and businesses waste billions and billions of dollars and tens of billions of dollars on excruciating paperwork and compliance every single year, and it never ends. Under our framework, the vast majority of families will be able to file their taxes on a single sheet of paper. We're also going to protect millions of family businesses by ending the crushing, horrible, and unfair estate tax, also known as the death tax. In fact, when it comes to business tax, we are now dead last among developed nations. We pay the highest tax of any nation in the world. Our rate is the least competitive rate there is. Our business tax rate is 60% higher than our average economic competitor. Think of that. America is finally back on the right track. But our country and our economy cannot take off like they should unless we transform America's outdated, complex, and extremely burdensome tax code.
Tax relief is on the way for the American family.
If I could say it as simple as possible, I would say that this tax reform conversation is about hashtag keep your money.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
A lot of big things going on in Washington this week with a tax reform bill proposed on September 27th. The market liking that news. Markets up this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Robin Griffith will be joining me, and he's saying, you know, by normal cycles, you should be out of the stock market right now, and he is a bit cautious. But he's going to tell you why you don't want to be completely out of equities, which areas of the world are performing the best, and why some very smart investors from Warren Buffett and Ray Dalio are raising some cash. He'll be joining me in the first hour. Also, my good friend Frank Barbera will be joining me, and we're going to be talking about gold. There is a certain cycle that has been picked up in the charts that starts around August and September over the last 3 years that sends gold south. We'll be talking about that and why, given all the uncertainties, geopolitical uncertainties that nobody's paying much attention to, and why we could have a sudden sell-off in the stock market, why you may want to have a hedge of gold. That will be Frank Barbera joining me in the first hour. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. Tax reform is the big buzz in Washington this week. We have had here the bull market being the second longest on record. Valuations are indeed stretched. And the question is, what could extend the expansion in the bull market, which might roll down a lot earlier? The answer is real, genuine tax reform. So then the question that follows next is it real tax reform, or is it going to be a Trojan horse, very much like what happened during the Reagan era when they took away deductions and lowered tax rates, and when nobody was looking 3 years later, raised the tax rates back up again. So that's the question. We're going to do an extended big picture, and instead of all of the hype, we're going to look at the numbers of what the proposals for this so-called tax reform are all about right here on the Big Picture on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first of all, before we dive into everything from the big picture, one of my more favorite parts of the program is to hear from Ryan Poplava, everything that went on Wall Street. Great week on Wall Street, Ryan, as many of the equity indices hit fresh all-time highs. with some of the cap laggards actually catching up and taking the lead, like the mid and small cap over large cap this week. So what would you say is driving the growth and optimism this week to finish the quarter on really such a good note? I mean, didn't the North Koreans basically say Trump declared war on them and they can shoot our bombers down? That sounds like an escalation of war, does it? I don't know. I mean, but the market didn't seem to care.
Yeah, it did care on Monday when that was announced. We saw tech stocks were opening up weak. Not really in response to that. It was just a little bit of profit taking. But when that announcement hit, we definitely saw some selling pressure intensify, but not enough to really jar things because Tuesday, you know, things were a little bit more normal. But that money didn't go into the sidelines. I mean, we did see some safety areas improve. We saw gold got right back above 1300. The money actually from tech was being rotated into energy. Energy was up pretty big that day. But the energy sector, just as a whole, as you know, we've been talking about energy quite a bit in the month of September. It's been a real big winner. And all the way to the end of the quarter, with many of the bullish catalysts that Jim and I have been highlighting for weeks now on the past shows. But it wasn't the only underdog to do well this month. You're right. You know, we did see the small cap and the mid cap really respond very well this week. Interestingly enough, there's been many intermarket relationships that have been really adjusted now due to the CPI figures early in the month, the IEA demand report for, you know, better global demand, what that's done on energy. Energy was a dog all year long. And now the Trump and Ryan's tax proposal this week, that was another major catalyst that has kind of shifted things a little bit.
Now, if our listeners haven't looked into the details yet of what is being proposed for the tax plan, Jim and I are going to do an in-depth analysis of what this really means on the big picture today. But could you at least for now summarize the key points of what you think this tax plan is going to do? Because I don't think we're really going to ultimately know until the bills go through and we get into reconciliation committee and we get a final proposal.
Right. We've seen that with healthcare, right? They had some ideas of what they wanted to do. Didn't turn out that way. There was a lot of adjustments that had to be made. And, you know, the big thing here with taxes, are there going to be some real concessions on where they're going to regain those revenues that they're going to lose from dropping rates? And that's what they're doing. Just to summarize, you know, the corporate tax rate will drop from 35% down to 20%. They're going to double the standard deduction for both single and married couples, but removing several other deductions. So I think you can only, not getting too in depth here, you can only do interest from mortgage, charity, and I think retirement deductions there in line items, but that could change. But from the seven tax brackets we have right now, they announced three, but they kind of said plus one more for the ultra wealthy and the ultra high income earners. So really four, from seven tax brackets down to four. They want to repeal the alternative minimum tax. Again, trying to simplify things. That's been the Republicans' MO. They want to kill the estate tax on estates worth $5.5 million. The other big one is where overseas profits would no longer be subject to U.S. tax to repatriate those funds back home, but rather a minimum foreign tax. So that's still kind of up in the air too. What are they going to do there as far as repatriating funds? Are they going to allow anything that's pre-existing right now overseas come back at a very ultra low rate? And then what do they do in the future? But they're discussing it. So that's another really major item that the Republicans have been focusing on for quite some time. But the Republicans were originally targeting something they wanted to call a tax reform bill, which means that you have really a budget neutral bill, where like in 1986 was the largest one that comes back to memory in history. You know, trying to make things fair and simplifying the tax code. That's the idea behind it. But when Trump came out on stage in Indiana on Wednesday to announce this tax bill after it had already been kind of leaked to the media, he basically really quite simply said it, this is a tax cut. That's what they're going for. Because if it was more tax reform, if it was more budget neutral, then we'd see other really major strategies like what Ryan suggested was the border adjustment tax earlier this year, but we're not getting that. And then, of course, we didn't get the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. That got completely squashed now this week. with the vote not even going to the Senate for the recent bill that was put together. That was another source of reducing expenditures to help with paying for the tax cuts. Both, like I said, they've been dropped. And so the Republicans are going now. They're going to push full ahead with a tax cut, some modifications here and there to justify it. We'll see how things play out between, you know, the parties and between the different factions in the Republican Party. There are still some reform parts to it, like only allowing the deductions for mortgage interest, retirement savings, charity, higher education. That's, you know, where the ball is going to fall when they finally vote on this. You know, it could be a different plan than what we just saw this week. And that's why I think maybe the market didn't react incredibly on it. It was muted, but still in the right direction.
Well, the stock market seemed to like the ideas. Do you think the market responded correctly? And look, we've watched 6 months of work go into trying to repeal or replace the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. That didn't get through Congress so far. We're not necessarily done with that, but we are for maybe this term. But they seem to like the tax proposal. So is that even realistic?
Overall, I think the market responded as it should. This is still being looked at as fiscal stimulus. Like I said, it's a tax cut, maybe being masked in reform. The plan says reform on it, but it's a good tax cut, and that's a good thing. To get the fiscal stimulus, there's lots of ways to do fiscal stimulus. There's spending or cutting taxes, different sides of the same coin. How did the market respond? We did see a fall in Treasury prices. We saw a drop in gold. We saw a drop in consumer staples. These are defensive areas, kind of the safety trade we talk about often on the show, while stocks rose. So we did get the response that Republicans were probably hoping for, investors were very much hoping for, and did get. And it was what we should have expected. But regardless, with what's going on, with whether, you know, things are going to look the way they are down the future, I think there is, you know, investors have been waiting for something they can really sink their teeth into, waiting for a major catalyst to push the market to record highs. And we definitely got that this week. In addition to the tax reform plan, we got quite a few data points, the Chicago PMI data on Friday, the durable goods report on Wednesday at the same time as the tax bill. That had really helped. That was up 1.75% for August. So definitely helpful, because those numbers go right into the durable goods report, goes right into third quarter GDP estimates. And, you know, those estimates have gone up this week.
All right, let's get into the details of the market response now. I mean, what areas seem to be working more so now, given the Trump reflation trade we saw back in November? Do you think it's back?
We're still seeing the rotation in energy. This has been developing before the tax announcement on Wednesday. And if you look at the sector, it's up like 6 weeks in a row now. But there are some other areas that did benefit a lot from the idea of cutting taxes for U.S. corporations, U.S. individuals. The two areas were small cap and financials. We saw quite a nice response there. Small cap stocks, they'd benefit with U.S. tax cuts, because most of the companies that are in these indices are U.S. based. They're domestic companies. They don't have a lot of exposure like the multinationals we see in the large cap indexes. We're also going to talk about, with what's going on with the small cap, also the financials, there's quite a bit of financials in the small cap indexes. And these financials are benefiting from the rise in yields we're seeing. We're seeing the rise in yields, not just based on the CPI figures, a couple of economic figures we've seen this month, which have been bullish, but the idea of, again, fiscal stimulus. Whether you're going to spend money as a government, or you're going to cut on how much you're taking in as revenues from taxpayers, to the bottom line, that's going to help taxpayers consume. So that's going to largely affect U.S. companies. So we're seeing both financials do well because of the yield going up with better economic expectations, and the small cap. Another area that hasn't had a lot of love, and I did talk about it a little bit last week, was when we were talking about technically what's going on in the market. We continue to see the retail industry improve. And that's an industry that I'm focusing on. It's part of the consumer discretionary sector and has been trading sideways for just 3 years. And I love looking at a sector or an industry group, or, you know, just an asset class that has gone nowhere maybe get some catalysts. You know, this fiscal stimulus could be a very much a catalyst for the consumer. Then seeing, you know, some improvement there, and we are. So we're seeing some improvement in the retail stocks. Quite a few I saw in the discount retailers were breaking out from some recent consolidations, and I like to see stuff like that. So that's definitely an area that I'm focusing in on.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for the in-depth analysis on the market trends and reactions to the tax plan this week. Now, let's move away from that, since that's been a hyper-focus. Anything else that you saw was what we would call, I guess, newsworthy or in economics that our listeners should probably be aware of?
It wasn't really market-moving news, but I thought it was important that maybe our listeners had heard that there were three different major central bank speakers this week, and specifically Yellen, who had said that the downward pressure on inflation could prove to be unexpectedly persistent, which sounded dovish off the top when she mentioned it. But she also said that without further increases in the federal funds rate, we run the risk that the labor market could overheat and we get some inflation priced in, and eventually the Fed may be behind the what we call the inflation curve, where they're not raising fast enough to compete with rising inflation expectations and inflation. So they don't want to get behind the curve. You know, they don't want to do that. They want to continue to gradually raise rates. They've done three this year, or actually they plan to do three this year with a December hike, and expectations are for the same thing next year. But what we did see in the dot plot estimates last week, I forget if I mentioned this to listeners last week, we did get a drop in the 2019 expectations. I know that's pretty far out there to really be talking about, but like I said, you know, when it comes to reading the tea leaves, as you would say, you know, everyone really focuses in on the Fed minutes, on the Fed announcements, and where they change things. They dropped rates from three expected hikes in 2019 down to two, with the long-term rates normalized at around 2.9%. So, you know, that I thought was pretty significant. Again, a little bit of dovish comments, but again, not full boring on the dovish side, saying we need to continue to raise rates. You know, the other thing on earnings, there were quite a few companies that announced this week, but I thought one of the most substantial one was Micron's earnings because of the effect it's had on the semiconductor industry and the technology sector this week. And great strength and recovery. Like you said, we had that drop off on Monday. Might have had a lot of traders and investors worried, but Micron's earnings did so well, and it had such an effect on everyone that we saw the whole sector and industry in semiconductors rise. And then it also helps that Wall Street's favorite stock to upgrade, NVIDIA, got another one on Friday. So NVIDIA's had a lot of love in September from Wall Street, and that's helping as well in the semiconductors. But I guess lastly, looking at the economics, there were a few numbers here. I talked about the durable goods. I didn't talk about housing. New sales were down, and that continues to point towards what I mentioned last week. Prices are high. Affordability is not there, so it's hurting sales. The other thing, too, is that we're not having enough supply coming into the market, new constructions and things like that. Obviously, a hurricane is going to hurt construction, and we've had a few of those. So that could be part of the problem right now on some of these seasonal numbers of what we've just gone through, what the country has. But, you know, housing is an area that slightly concerning. If we don't have the supply to keep prices affordable, then we're not going to get the sales. And that's essentially what's happening. But it all, you know, equilibrium, capitalism, it's all going to work out. But on the economic side, the one thing I did find interesting was the PCE price index, which came out as a component of the personal income and spending report released on Friday. It was underwhelming. And year over year was up only 1.4% for August. And that's kind of contradictory to what we saw in the consumer price index much earlier in the month. And that had a lot of catalyst and driver effect to it. So it was interesting to see that, and how did the market react? Market was still up. Treasury yields were kind of all over the place during the day's trading, because in the afternoon, here we go, Chicago PMI was up very nicely, up to like 65 from, I think, 58 or 59, up decently. And from what I understand, the backlog is at a 29-year high. So economics were very interesting this week as well, on top of all the announcements. And then next week, as you know, John, we're going to get a key week in the month in economics. We get the ISM reports, manufacturing, non-manufacturing, and then jobs report. Those are always very key catalysts and drivers to pay attention to.
All in all, it's been a really exciting week, I think, and it's going to be interesting to watch this tax debate play out. You've got all these lobbyists in there who want to assure their status in it. You're going to have all of the posturing back and forth. And what this ultimately does is it clouds the ability of the average taxpayer or citizen to say, well, what's going on here? Because there are claims, counterclaims, counterclaims. How do you sort that all out? And as Jim will say, coming up in the big picture, the only thing you can really do is take a hardcore look at the numbers and stop with all the hype that goes. So we'll be doing that in the big picture and hope to see you again next week, Ryan Poplava. It was a wonderful report.
Sounds good, John. We'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
I think it's the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, facing, you know, state and local government and school districts. So he's not overstating it. In fact, I think most people are understating the problem, especially most government officials, pension officials, because as I mentioned, I mean, these costs are increasing at 3-4 times every 5-10 years. It's unsustainable. Pretty soon, you know, 95% of your budget will be going to pay retirement costs. And so it's unsustainable if people still want to get core government services from their school district and local governments and fire departments and police departments and that sort of thing. Something's got to change because the costs are just going to keep squeezing out more and more services.
Well, autumn is usually that part of the year where stock markets turn volatile. Volatility increases, we usually see major corrections, and then stocks pick up as we head in towards the end of the year. But this year is unusual. We've had one record after another, and this fall has seen very little volatility. Joining us on the program is Robin Griffith. I guess, Robin, I want to talk about this fall, usually around this time of the year, as I said in the opening there. We normally see volatility return to the market. If we're going to get a correction, it usually happens at this time of the year. We haven't seen it. What accounts for that?
We haven't, but this is indeed the start of the so-called dead zone. There's something like 240 years worth of data that suggests, particularly in our Western markets, that there are cycles that we need to pay attention to, an annual seasonal deviation being one of them, and a 4-year cycle and a 10-year cycle. And the 10-year cycle is especially powerful because it's in the second half of the seventh year of the decade, 1987 and others, when you not only get a seasonal dip, you get a fairly major reset. So if we just believed in the cycles, we would be out of the market and sit on cash for a bit. The actual probability is just over 70% probability that if you buy the market today, you will have lost money by Christmas. That doesn't make it a certainty, of course. And as you rightly say, there's absolutely no sign of it in the markets at the moment. The trends are resolutely upwards. When I look at all world markets and divide them into quintiles of the strongest down to the weakest, the top quintile is entirely world equity markets. And if you just followed the trends, you'd be fully invested in equities. There is a but. The equities that you would be in to make the most money are India, China, and emerging markets. Then comes a passive holding of the global index. The markets that, although strong and at highs, are underperforming those other ones are, in fact, the UK and the USA. So we're strong by our own standards, but we're actually underperforming those other ones. And, of course, when you then bring in concepts of value to it, it's our markets, particularly the US, but Britain as well, which are expensive. However, if you just look at the chart of the S&P or the NASDAQ or any of the other indices, you say, well, look, it's going up. There have been very little, few dips, and you've been right to buy the dips. When you look a little deeper again, you find that The market cap weighted indices give you a little bit of a funny picture because it's a very few, very large cap stocks which are actually doing most of the business. On my work, roughly half the stocks in the S&P 500 are actually not in uptrends at all. But the FANGs and the NOSHes, to use those two acronyms, those have been powerhouses just trending up. And the VIX index of volatility is incredibly low. I mean, if one was an ordinary hedge fund, you'd be very tempted to just buy the VIX for volatility to pick up. Although lots of people have tried that, and it hasn't made them money. In this so-called new normal, which is a world of modest growth, very low interest rates, and incredibly low volatility, it's almost as though we're not allowed to have setbacks. It feels unnatural. It's as though we don't have free capitalist markets decided by buyers and sellers anymore. We have intervened markets with excess liquidity looking for a return, and it has to get that in equities. And it's going for the growth equities and not the value. Value investing has not only not worked, it's been punished. And a certain very famous value investors whose work I love reading, they've been getting beaten up. And even the legendary Warren Buffett, he's not sitting on $100 billion of cash because he can find plenty of things to buy, is he? He's at windy of a reset. And even Ray Dalio, the largest hedge fund on the planet, has been sending out very good work saying, okay, the trends are up, but we like to rebalance our portfolios so we don't get caught out when we're wrong. And I'm on exactly that plank as well. Because I have spent a lifetime looking at the cycles and believing in the cycles, and also some time looking at value, although my charts are incredibly strong in all equities, I just don't want to be fully invested between now and Christmas. In thinking in terms of risk-reward, if I'm not in the market between now and Christmas, what am I likely to miss out on? And at the moment, we haven't missed out on much because, well, the dollar's been weak, so has sterling been weak. So if you come into it from somewhere else on the planet, rather than it being your home market, the currency's undone much of what you might have made in the stocks. And if you weren't in the FANG and NOSH stocks, you weren't making money anyway. So I don't think we're missing much by being cautious at the moment. And having the money available, if there is a reset, and there is a probability of a reset, then we're going to be able to buy a bargain when it crops up. But having said that, I don't think we need to be mega gloomy. I mean, I look at it from the world point of view, and the fact is the world economy is actually in quite good shape, growing overall at approximately 4% per annum, which is a good number. And increasingly, the economic data said that looks quite sustainable and steady. I mean, some people worry about the P.E. ratio, the Shiller P.E. on America, and others worry about the credit bubble in China. But experts on China said, look, it looks quite stable to us. If anything, their growth rate is going to pick back up again. China's growing at about 5.5% at the moment. It might even work out at 6%. And these days, we increasingly believe the Chinese numbers more than we used to. We then look at geopolitical risks. Are we really going to have World War III with North Korea? The South Koreans don't think so. I've been to the DMZ myself on numerous occasions, and the South Koreans have lived with this throughout their entire career. We do this saber-rattling, and we don't kill each other. We do business. So all in all, I can't see what's going to end the trends, and it's just the valuation and the cyclicals that make me want to be risk-averse for a few months, basically.
So when you look at this and you talk about this new normal where we really don't have in many ways free markets because you do have central banks intervening with liquidity and that's still out there, maybe the Fed is holding back. Is it an issue, Robin, of institutions? If I'm an insurance company or let's say a pension plan, I have to earn some kind of rate of return. So in many ways, I am forced to play the market, whether I'm trying to pick up a high-paying dividend stock or searching the globe for yield, because how else am I going to provide for my pensioners?
Yeah, you're right. The likely return from markets is currently a lot less than we all got used to in our younger days. The idea that you could make 8 to 10 by being invested in equities year after year, and sometimes rather more than that. I don't think we're in that sort of world at all. We've got no clean shirt clothes to wear, but we're trying to pick the cleanest dirty shirt from the laundry and wear it one more time. It's that sort of thing. I think the excess liquidity and the ultra-low interest rates have caused a lot of mispricings, and the biggest mispricing is in the bond market. Because the economies all around the world are in relatively okay shape now, most central banks, not just the Fed, but most central banks would like to use this little bit of an opportunity, if they can, to try and creep interest rates gently back to what would have been sustainable under the old normal. What that number is, it's usually what can the economy grow at plus what is the inflation rate. So even in a low growth environment, if your economy might grow at 2.5% to 3% and is, say, 2% inflation, the rate of interest on the sort of 10-year bond of around 4.5% to 5%, we're going to be able to live with that. But of course, if we were to suddenly make the yield go back from where it is to there, that would crash a few things. So it's got to be done on a very, very gentle basis. And one of the things I worry about is so much of daily transactions is done by algorithmic machines. They're not even human beings taking these decisions. That when they turn one way or the other, they'll all turn together. And at the moment, the winners have all been in, what, roughly 9 high-tech stocks. I mean, even in China, to change the subject, roughly a half of all the growth in the Chinese market has been down to 3 giant internet stocks. So it's the same sort of syndrome over there as we've got in the West as well. So, and this is, it's fragile, to use a sort of expression that Nicholas Taleb would use. It's quite stable at the moment, but it's a fragile kind of strength that the market's got. And it could reverse. We won't see it coming. In England, we say you don't get hit by a red double-decker bus coming down the road because you can see it. You get hit by the little van coming out of a side road that you weren't even paying attention to. So I think there's going to be a correction. The role model I would use would be something like 1987, when we were actually early in a secular uptrend. And yet we still came in and the market was down 25% in a couple of days. That can happen because of this fragility and because so much money is focused on so few stocks. I've even seen a few comments from some highly respected people saying, sell the fangs and the noshes, just take risk off the table. In our work, we've even back-tested this, that if you rebalance your portfolio regularly, like about quarterly, that involves selling the top off your best performing holdings, which is usually wrong. But at least you're putting profits in the bank regularly. So if you suddenly get caught out, it keeps you in the game longer. It doesn't make you more money, but it keeps you alive longer. And I feel quite strongly about this, that we shouldn't just be fully invested in equity markets, although that's where the trends are at the moment. We should put on a slight asset allocation in case our bet is wrong. And that involves owning, in a strong currency, there's nothing wrong to owning the cash. And actually, in the specific case of the USA, it's actually been such a weak currency recently, it's overdue for a bounce. So for the next couple of months, actually owning cash in the dollar might be quite a good idea. I mean, in my ranking order, gold comes about halfway down the list. It's sort of okay without being great. But it's not terribly bad either. So owning something in gold in case our equity bets are wrong is good. And if the price of bullion were to go above my level is $1,383 an ounce, I think if it went above there, you would get every gold bug coming out of the woodwork big time, and it would have a much more powerful move. But for as long as it's below that level, it's just a rally, basically. And on the downside, roughly 1,200. There's a whole bunch of levels not far from 1,200. It's in a sort of range. It's doing better than plenty of other assets, but otherwise it's sort of middle range. The one surprise on my work, the only thing that isn't an equity index, which is in the top quintile, is industrial metals. Copper is the big one, which has had an enormous surge. It might have a little pullback because these things never go in a straight line. Industrial metals are the only thing in the commodity space that looks really good to me. And there's a reason for it, of course. They had endured a huge five-year bear market. They'd got down to levels where many of the mining companies were on the verge of, well, not mining anymore, if they can even stay in the game. They got really, really cheap. And now, of course, as the global economy is going at about 4%, and we're all moving away from oil into electric everything, an electric motor is a lot of copper wiring. So whether the vehicle is powered by a battery or a fuel cell or something else doesn't make any difference. The motor's going to be in electric wiring. So the demand for copper is going to pick up and up and up. And also the big infrastructure projects, particularly the new Silk Road in China, which is just enormous, that's going to use mountains of copper. So particularly in that one and the metals that go with it, like cobalt, because you need that in the batteries, lithium, all that sort of thing. These metals look to me as though they are in a secular trend and you should be buying dips and be overexposed to them. But everything else in the commodity space comes well down the ranking order, and that includes oil. Oil's not at the bottom with all the agricultural ones, but it's not strong. Put it this way, if North Korea fires a missile and we have a little bit of a conflict, of course the price of oil will spike up. But these days, there is a swing producer in the oil market, and it's not who it used to be. These days, the swing producer, the fracking guys in America, and they're very, very significant. And if the price of their oil goes down, they can stop fracking. And if the price of it goes up, they can start fracking a hell of a lot more aggressively than they do. And I think this swing production will have a big effect on the price. But the giant story is we're moving away from the oil market into much cleaner fuel systems, which are going to use electricity more. And therefore, the notion that the price of oil will go sustainably up past, say, 65 into the hundreds, I just don't buy it. That's not the world I think we're moving into. So it will fluctuate from somewhere between $40 a barrel and, let's say, 65. And roughly every time it goes much over 50, I'm out of there, basically. And many of the oil companies are increasingly seeing themselves as energy companies. They're going to sell you some gas or energy in other forms. They're not just oil companies, really. That's why, apart from a short-term trade, I can't get myself excited about the prospects for oil.
Let me bring up something that you brought up earlier, and that was, if you look at the S&P, only half of these companies are doing well. Half of them are in downturns, and really it's the large cap stocks that are really moving the indexes. Something that really concerns me today, you mentioned algorithm trading, that it's not even humans, it's just computers. But something else is also occurring, Robin, that I've been watching, and that is this passive indexing, where all this money goes into indexing funds. I think I was reading last night that 29% of all equity funds are in index funds. When you're in an index fund, if it's NASDAQ, you're going to buy 13% of the money you take in is going to go into Amazon. What happens when you have so much money in these passive funds, which are buying these big FANG type stocks because they're the large cap stocks within the index? What happens when John Q. Public or some institution decides that they want to get out of these index funds? And more importantly, all of these index funds are controlled by mainly five large entities controlled the index funds. What happens when that occurs?
Absolutely. This is the fragility that we were talking about. There's no one those guys can sell to. At the moment, because that type of hedge fund that used to charge 2+20, although and really swing for the big hits, they've been losing money. That process, I mean, over here we've got several very famous people. Many of the fund managers have actually given up. And so the public is forced into the index-linked funds. And at the moment, the pendulum is swinging right over there. However, it's bound to swing back again eventually for two reasons. The value that you get in these giant stocks is getting progressively worse. I mean, these are not the stocks with big dividends or even big earnings. These are just the ones with large market caps going up. Eventually, the management of the company will issue paper to do takeovers, because if you got effectively to them some free money in the days of Ling Temco Board and the other conglomerates, you can play that game and end up owning an awful lot of businesses just with your own little private printing press. So they'll do that, and that will dilute value. And as they say, if one of them wants to sell, there's no one big enough the other side to buy, so the fragility will show up. There is another thing. This is, I feel passionately, that why can we not beat, let's say, pick an index, a nice index, like the S&P 500. If you think about it, your chance, your probability of picking the very best stock in the index at any given moment is one shot in 500. However, lots of stocks will be average or below average. Your chance of picking one of them is probably 250 chances. And for each stock you can identify, which good or bad is just going to perform at average or below average, and you don't own it, you're going to beat the index by that amount. And then, in fact, the distribution of performance is never around the middle anyway. It's always skewed over, so that in most indices, to a greater or less extent, more than half of all stocks perform in average or below average ways. It's all only ever the top third or less even where you need to be in each time. Those trends run until they stop and then something else replaces them. So basically, somebody who took an index-linked contract out and then shorted half the stocks in the index would automatically outperform the index. Of course, you have to find a counterparty to take the risk the other side. And it's done in the sort of size for an average private client, that's easy to do. But done in the size of the giant five institutions who control the market, I don't know that that's possible to do. But the way to beat an index is not to own all of it. I've back-tested this as a sort of academic exercise on 40 different world markets. And it's not that difficult to do. You will beat it incrementally by every stock in the index that you don't need to own, which is quite an interesting thing, isn't it, really? A more concentrated portfolio, but not excessively concentrated, is a much better way to go. Now, if sticking to the S&P 500, if you had 3% of your money in each of the top 30 stocks, you've still got quite a well-diversified portfolio. And yet you're in the stocks which are performing brilliantly. And as you rebalance your portfolio monthly or quarterly, anything that's no longer in the top decile, you kick it out and replace it with the one that is. So you only ever own those stocks which are in the sweet spot of actually performing now. And I don't think it'll be long before one of those big institutions or a hedge fund will run portfolios along this basis, because that is the way, without taking excessive individual stock risk, to beat the indices.
Absolutely amazing in the world that we're living in, because as you mentioned, the markets are changing in so many ways, whether it's the new normal with liquidity or you have passive index funds, which are driving the valuations, because it was amazing. I did a study on these FANG stocks. And the thing that really struck me, Robin, was who in their right mind would be buying Amazon at 200 times earnings? And when I looked at the top FANG stocks and the top 10 stocks in the indexes, they were all held, the largest owners were the index funds themselves. And so once again, you have a huge concentration in a small group of stocks and a huge concentration in players that own all these stocks. So it's going to make for an interesting configuration when it unwinds. Robin, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
We have a website called globalinvestmentroadmap.com. And although that was originally set up for institutions only, we have now put a lot of stuff on that website designed for private individuals. So I'm delighted to say by popular demand, there's products there that private investors might think they should have that. It was originally set up just for some of these giant institutions we've been talking about. And there is a monthly newsletter that goes there as well.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Here's a reminder that if you're not listening to the daily Financial Sense News Hour, you're really missing a lot. Let me show you.
The earnings picture in the U.S. is still looking pretty solid, and so you haven't really seen all that much multiple expansion in the last few months. You've seen earnings growing into what admittedly are fully priced multiples. And we look at two specific dynamics across sectors to gauge the longevity of what has been a pretty decent recovery in operating margins. and that is pricing power and cost structure. And what we see is that above trend economic growth, including the recent softness in the U.S. dollar, is helping the top line for many corporations this year at a time when wage growth is flat, around 2.5% nominal. And so the ability of companies to expand volume and or find some pricing power in this environment is creating this reflationary window for equities, which remains a fertile backdrop for the market, because this is happening in the context of what is still a fairly benign inflation environment, meaning that the risk of the Fed murdering the business cycle anytime soon is quite low.
Well, everybody has been focusing on the stock market this year, but there's another asset class that has also been doing well, and that's precious metals, gold, almost hitting 1400, but it's pulling back. Is this just a midterm rally, or is something more serious going on? Joining me on the program is my good friend Frank Barbera. And Frank, you and I were talking just before we went on the air, just looking at a price of gold, how it tends to, in the last couple of years, will either peak somewhere in the July to October range, then it goes down towards the end of the year and then takes off again. It's done that the last 2 or 3 years. Can you think of anything technically or fundamentally that would account for this?
You know, it's an interesting point, Jim, and I see what you're getting at. I think over the last 3 to 4 years, that's certainly been the pattern, and we have seen that pattern in other years going back to 2008. But classically, from the late 1960s, when gold first started trading, if you were taking the way you do seasonal work, you take every trading year and you line them all up in a spreadsheet, starting in January, all the January dates aligned right through December, and then you sort of take a horizontal average of all the years. And what used to come up with in sort of the classic book on gold is an August low, and then strength in August, strength in September, and then generally a peak in early the following year, a peak in January. You know, I don't know whether or not, you know, just how robust those seasonals are. It's something that I followed kind of lightly over time, but I would agree with you that certainly has been a pattern over the last 3 or 4 years. And with the market coming off an overbought high that we just saw on September 7th, it certainly means that it's something we have to pay attention to, you know, and keep maybe at the forefront in our minds going forward. So far, I would say that the gold market has not done anything to really trip off a big negative. We had a nice uptrend in spot gold from a low of around 1207 on July 10th, up into those early September highs around 1357. It gained around 12.5%, and it's given back approximately half of those gains. But in the process, it has pulled back into an area of pretty thick support, the April 18th highs and the June 7th highs. There's a big fat area between 1290 and 1300, which looks like pretty strong support for the gold price. And I'd say I'd give it a little attaboy today, in the sense that as we're here at the end of the week, the price is bouncing off that area, and it looks like it's doing a pretty good job trying to firm up. So we ended at around 1280, basically around 1296 today on spot gold. So that's a reasonably decent showing over the last 24 hours or so.
Now, Frank, usually when you see gold, which is overall is still having a good year, even though it's pulled back recently, do you like to see the other metals confirm, like silver, platinum, and then the stocks to get a confirmation? It's almost like the Dow theory, where you have the transports confirming the industrials. Well, if gold's the main precious metal, then you take a look at silver, and then you take a look at the stocks. Do you like to see those two confirm the movement of gold to tell you that, hey, this thing's real?
I love the question, and more often than not, I would say sure. I think that lens is the lens that looks at gold as an inflation hedge. You know, the typical pattern or at least one of several patterns that applies to gold. You'd have an economy and economic expansion, which would tend to rev up over time. And as you got late in the expansion, you'd see inflation picking up strongly. And then the gold price would pick up along with inflation. And then at the end of the expansion, the Fed would tighten credit, invert the yield curve, and the whole thing would tilt over into a recession. I think the dynamics that we're dealing with right now are very, very different. Really, I think the situation is one where gold can depart in this cycle from the other metals. I'm not a big bull on silver, and I'm definitely not a big bull on any of the precious metals. I would label myself at the moment, I'm in the deflation camp. I think the equity market looks like it's near a potentially major high, and I think we could be starting pretty soon the beginning of a serious correction or downside move in stocks. And that will then change a lot of the dynamics. I think the fact that the Fed right now has a very high probability of a December rate hike, I think if the stock market comes down, all those odds will fall. The dollar could start to break down because right now the thing that's sort of giving the dollar a rally is the fact that it looks like the Fed may be hiking rates a bit. But Janet Yellen herself said it the other day, inflation has been less than expected. Growth has been less than expected. I call this recovery that we've been in the last 7 to 8 years really the defibrillator recovery, because it's like the patient died on the table back in 2008. And then they used historic, you know, great means, efforts to revitalize him, you know, with the defibrillator paddles. That was all the injection of central bank money. And every couple of years, he starts to fade, the poor guy, and they just hit him with the paddles again. But with all of the credit expansion, all of the money printing, all we've really had is a 2% plateau in growth. And we really have not gotten the economy. You have, you know, a huge number of people not in the labor force. You have, generally speaking, in terms of the global economy, a huge labor arbitrage where companies have been outsourcing jobs to labor in Asia, where it's a lot cheaper. And that's just generally kept wage inflation pinned down. I think the, at least in terms of price inflation, that has been completely absent. We have not seen really the classic money multiplier, the classic pickup in velocity. All of those things, all of those indicators have been dead during the course of this cycle. And I think there's a real risk here that what we have, I'm going to borrow a little liberally with due credit to Doug Nolan over at the Credit Bubble Bulletin. I think we've really had a hyperinflation of credit over the last 10 years, you know, money has been yield chasing increasingly poorer and poorer quality of paper. We're in a situation where almost 30% of the total issuance of bonds globally has a negative interest rate associated, which is scary. And I think at this stage of the game, if there were to be a break in the stock market, it would have a huge negative wealth effect. And it would be something that at this particular juncture, the global central banks would really have a hard time coping with. I think it would be exceptionally deflationary. And in that sense, I think money might begin to question their ability of to be able to keep Humpty Dumpty in one piece and say, okay, side bet, we're betting on some gold here just as an asset of last resort. And so in that sense, I think in a deflationary outcome, I think you get gold moving a lot higher. And I don't think that necessarily implies silver or platinum. Those other metals usually move well when you get a traditional recovery that's doing well and beginning to overheat. Silver is the classic inflation hedge. And usually when inflation is picking up, that's the number one performer. I think we're at the opposite end. I think we're at the end of the credit cycle. And I think we're really heading for potentially some negative shocks in the months ahead.
You know, the thing that really strikes me, and you were saying that in a traditional cycle, if you take a look at this economic recovery using your defibrillator recovery analogy, one thing that we've seen that has been consistent, you'll see the economy do real well in maybe the second and third quarter. And by the fourth quarter in the first quarter, it begins to weaken again. And we certainly saw that with Fed action, where the Fed would delay, like, for example, in 2015 and 2016, they only went with one rate cut per year because we haven't gotten that traditional. But there's something else I'm also seeing here, and you refer to it that, you know, people are out there, I don't care if you're a pension fund, CalPERS, or an insurance company, you're trying to get a return, as well as investors who are retired. But Frank, we have something else going on in the market that I've never seen before. And that is the widespread use of what I call passive indexing. I read last night a report that 29% of all equity funds are index funds. And Frank, along with algorithmic trading, passive index funds, when these managers get money, the money is going and gravitating towards these large cap stocks like Amazon, because I think last time you were on the program, we were talking about, I was looking at all these large cap funds. And if you look at the S&P, half of the S&P 500 is in a downturn, but you wouldn't know that if you were looking at the average. So all of this money is going into these index funds, which is what's driving the FANG stocks, the Amazons, the Facebooks. But here's another caveat I would throw in there too, that's an anomaly. If you take a look at the index funds, those index funds are owned by five main players. So Frank, you know, we're sitting in a room and there's five of us guys and we decide there's a fire or we need to get rid of some. Who are you going to sell to? What index fund, if there's five index families or companies that control all index funds, who are they going to sell to when they want to get out?
That's a really good, that reminds me of the old Ghostbusters jingle, who are you going to call? Good question. I don't think there's an answer to that. And that, by the way, is probably a reason why when this decline does start, it'll be a lot of money moving to the door very quickly. And I think the lack of that big transition into passive management and away from active management will actually make stock market declines more unwieldy and faster moving forward. It's also true that one of the big trades has been selling volatility, and that has a lot of leverage embedded in that trade. That's a very crowded trade. And I think that would be something that could work a lot like portfolio insurance on the downside. So I think people right now, what you have to understand, and here's a little context, this is the second longest bull market in history. You know, the only one really longer was the 1991 through 2000 NASDAQ move, which was 9 years. And we're rapidly coming up in terms of the total week count towards a match of that. We are longer than 1929. We are longer than some of the longest prior stock market runs, not only in the United States, but in Japan, in Hong Kong, in the UK, in Germany. We did a study where we went around the world the last 50, 60 years, and this is really one of the longest bull markets in history. Second point, we have now gone the longest period in time without a 5% correction in the Dow. I did that on my computer the other day back to 1920. This is the longest stretch without a 5% correction. And on the S&P, it's the third longest. This is this week that we're talking, Jim, the week ended September 29th, will be week number 81 for the S&P without a 5% correction. The two prior longest were 82 weeks and 89 weeks going back over the last 65 years. This is a stock market that is seriously due for a 5% correction. And what's really interesting is when you look at the internals of the market, the last couple of months, it's been a big shell game. You've had the averages sort of moving up quietly, but you've had a lot of weakness in, like, for example, when we last spoke, Amazon was knocking on $1,000 a share, and we've subsequently seen that pull back to lows around 930. And it's true, it's taken a little bounce off those lows over the last few days, but Google, Facebook, if you go right down the list of the FANGs and a whole bunch of other stocks, you'll see a lot of stocks have come materially off the highs and have really not made any net gains over the last couple of months. And that tells me there's distribution going on. And the leadership, we saw the NASDAQ a couple of days ago hit a new high, and there wasn't one of the five stocks making a new high. No Apple, no Google, no Netflix, no Tesla, no Amazon. And that tells you the air is getting pretty thin. When that's happening and you're this far out, you know, any kind of trigger that comes along could be the thing that pretty easily catalyzes a stock market decline. I like the long side of volatility, although that's a pretty risky trade. It's really probably something for professionals. But to me, when I see the VIX down where it is, it looks like it's really near some kind of probably a secular low in addition to a cyclical low. So I think the path ahead, PIMCO just put out a piece 2 days ago, and they said this is probably as good as it gets. And I would kind of tend to agree with that assessment. I think people have probably, you know, should be aware of minding the risk in their portfolios. And when you look at the situation that's coming up, there are a lot of global macro factors in the weeks and months ahead that could actually turn out to be something of a trigger for a market pullback.
You know, Frank, one of the things that really strikes me about this market is after the election of President Trump, the markets moved in anticipation of very favorable things happening to the market. The repeal of Obamacare, tax cuts, infrastructure spending, deregulation. They couldn't repeal Obamacare. They just rolled out the tax package, which we're going to cover in the big picture on the program today. But if you take a look at some of the things in the tax cuts, for people like you and I that live in California, if they do away with, you know, the deductibility of property taxes or state taxes, for people that live in New York, New Jersey, you know, Oregon, or even, you know, we're actually going to have tax hikes here. So a couple things. Number one, this tax bill may not do what they think it's going to do because there's actually could be a tax increase for a lot of people. But secondly, what happens, Frank, if they can't even get this through?
See, that's where I'm coming from, JP. I think that's exactly right. When they announced this tax plan yesterday, we saw, you know, the first set of cries that came from the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party far right were, it's not revenue neutral. It's going to add $2.5 trillion to the deficit over the next 5 or 10 years. The Democrats came punching back and saying, you know, this is tax breaks for the rich. And they had their arguments. And Matt Drudge labeled it as a total betrayal by Trump of the, he said, you know, the two parties are the same and it's going to be end up being a tax hike on the wealthy. So, you know, when you just look at the media coverage was so splintered, all these different factions sort of saw it their way. You know, I think this has gotten very complicated because what you really are dealing with, even though the Republicans have control of the House and the Senate, you have these strong factions in the Republicans. It's really not a fully unified Republican Party, and that makes it difficult to get things done. I think also the fact that they couldn't get the health care done originally, the big idea of a big boon in terms of tax cuts that was going to stimulate the economy, a lot of that money was supposed to be saved by doing health care first. It was about $1 trillion that might have come from the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. When that failed, it sort of puts the tax reform probably more into the idea of tax reform light. And I think that's where we're going. And what you may end up finding is that it's tax reform with a huge battle that's protracted over a very long time. And I think that is something the stock market was not counting on. It's not won't like. And that may be one of the triggers that's coming down the pike in the area of disappointment. This is a market that's priced at a very high multiple, and it's been counting on those key Trump elements, the classic stimulative Republican economic plan. And if that seems like it's faltering, which it does, I think there's a pretty good chance that that's an element that could begin to creep into the stock market in the form of uncertainty. And the longer the debate drags on, the more the market will probably start to sell off. And that's the one thing the market hates is uncertainty.
Well, I can tell you right now, just doing a deep dive, taking a look at what's moving the indexes higher, and you've been following bull markets for a long time, and you know, Frank, towards the end of a market or the end of a bull market, the indexes are hitting new highs, so everybody thinks happy days are here again, and it can only go higher. But if you start looking internally, it's only the generals, the large cap stocks at the top, that are moving the indexes, which is what is exactly happening now. Because most people, if you were to tell them that almost 50% of the S&P 500 stocks are in a downtrend, they wouldn't believe you.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the funny thing is that even the world of technical analysis sometimes does not do a service. Jim, one of the most common indicators out there is the advanced decline line, the cumulative advanced decline line. And I can tell you that has been really co-opted over time by changes in the way the old days, I'm sure we can both date ourselves a little bit. I remember when stocks used to trade in eighths. Right? Eighths, quarters, five-eighths, three-eighths, three-quarters. And the average share of stock was much lower. So the average percentage change on a daily basis, it took a little bit more percentage change in the old days to have a stock actually move into the up or the down column. With digital prices over the last few years, as that has taken root, you can see the advanced decline line has had a huge upward skew. And internally here at Salem, we've been building our own using percentage delta, and that's been weakening quite a bit over the last number of weeks. So it goes right to support what you're suggesting, is that, you know, there are faulty indicators out there that I don't think are really working anymore, and I think they need a lot of correction. We really the right database to come up with the right outcome. And what we see is a lot of stocks not making new highs, and the internal strength of the market clearly diverging. And so that's a big red flag. It's also true that last week, some of the polls hit new all-time highs. I think it was Gallup did a poll of, it was University of Michigan did a poll of investors. It hit the highest, most optimistic levels on the stock market since the March of 2000 high on the NASDAQ. And that's a combination that's really usually very dangerous when you have excessive sentiment and you have internals weakening. So that's usually a good one-two punch for a correction. Now, all that said, and I've been very clear about this, you can try to anticipate a turn and you can look at yourself and say, okay, this is late in a cycle, the market's extended, but until it actually starts to break down and you start to see trend confirmation of prices falling, you don't want to be getting too aggressively bearish. For the S&P, for example, we're at about 2510 right now. You would really need to see a close back below 2482. That's the first key level. And then I would argue that the August 21st levels, lows at 2417, call it 2400 as a fat pencil line. That's a much more important level. If we see a close down below that, I think at that stage of the game, it could be, you know, you could get a big break towards 2250 to 2300 on the S&P. So watch 2480 and then 2400 to 2420. Those are the initial signals. On the NASDAQ, which is around 6453 right now, the key support level, the first one is 6340. And then below that, again, the August 21st lows are 6177. If we actually broke that low at 6177 on the NASDAQ, I would think that the next step would be a big step down towards 5800 and then maybe 5500. So you do need to be patient. And sometimes patience right here is the most difficult commodity to find, because it's tempted to look at all these factors and say the picture is turning bearish and then anticipate it. But it's usually a good thing to actually let the trend start to decay and then follow it down. Once you start seeing some of these initial support levels like the 2480 and the 6340 on the NASDAQ, once those are broken, that will give you a little bit more substance to go on to suggest, okay, this trend is really starting to turn down.
So in summary, Frank, maybe given all these things, the thing that strikes me is a lot of this stuff that people used to follow. You talked about traditional indicators like the advanced decline line. A lot of this has all gotten distorted. You've seen it with passive indexing, which is driving these huge multiples in prices in the FANG stocks. You've seen it in economic patterns in the economy, where we have two quarters of good growth every year, and then we have two down quarters. So they bring out the defibrillators and they revive the patient. And even the Fed itself, I had to laugh, Frank. Frank, and you're old enough to remember this, when Jimmy Carter was once asked about inflation, he said, you know, he couldn't understand it. It rises in strange and mysterious ways. Well, we got just the reverse with Yellen the other day, and she couldn't understand why we haven't seen inflation. So it's kind of like inflation, she was saying, was mysterious to her. So we just want to let our listeners know that we are not operating under normal parameters, indicators, and models that we've typically, that you put in a textbook, and this is what you learn when you go to school. This is a different kind of market.
That's right. Now, Yellen's still using the sort of Nehru model, the Phillips curve model of, you know, low unemployment means, you know, upward pressure on wages and theoretically tight capacity, high capacity utilization. That just doesn't seem to be working. And I think the culprit in there is the fact that so much of the employment data over the years has become co-opted. You actually have a lot of people working two or three jobs, but they're not full-time jobs. And so a lot of people are really not in the labor force. There's an excess supply out there of Americans not in the labor force. And there's also a big, huge, you've had a global labor arbitrage over the last few years where, you know, a lot of corporate America has been outsourcing jobs to different countries. And so that global labor supply is putting downward pressure. There's a lot of reasons why I don't think inflation is coming back anytime soon and why this cycle is truly different. And the Fed starting to bring down the balance sheet, that's light tightening, and hiking rates is light tightening. This is the kind of thing where if you get the ECB starting to taper in a couple of months, you would have possibly the kind of a note that would be hit that could shake a very shaky structure. So I do think that monetary tightening at some point can go just a little too far. And in this kind of situation where things are at best in a delicate balance, it may not be able to take very much of that. So taking the punch bowl away late in the cycle, it could inadvertently tip things into a slowdown. I'm also concerned about China, Jim, and their upcoming October meeting. I think one of the things they may come out of that with would be possibly a bit of a deleveraging. I think China may come out post its mid-October meeting and talk about lowering its growth targets, doing some forced deleveraging in the state-owned enterprises. And I think that's another issue that, along with trade, which I think could continue to be a major issue with protectionism and the Trump administration pushing China very hard on North Korea. They're very, very motivated to deal with North Korea. And right now they're trying to do that by applying a lot of financial pressure. But somewhere in all of this, you could see some real tensions arise in trade. And that may be another trigger. I think Asia, the whole region, is potentially a big flashpoint for all of us in the months ahead.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, Jim, we have a complimentary newsletter we publish from time to time. And you just email us at info@salempartners.com, and we'll be happy to send that out.
Tax reform seems to be the new buzz on the street. Congress is considering that, and we're being promised all sorts of things. So there's the hype, the counter-hype, the hope, and then there's the reality. And the reality is when you really look at the numbers and see what's being proposed. And surprise, surprise, that's what Jim Poplava and I are going to do in the big picture today. It will be an extended big picture to dismantle or dissect, is a better word, to dissect what is being proposed in this tax plan and who it affects, how it affects investments. Stay with us as the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture continue at financialsense.com.